Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Literature suggests that nearly 30% of adults admitted to a hospital may experience delirium. The aftermath of this cognitive impairment may last months and possibly years beyond hospital discharge. Antipsychotic medications have been considered the mainstay of delirium management, but recent literature suggests the tide may be turning and that perhaps antipsychotics are not as effective in delirium as we once thought. Dr. Abby Hendricks, an internal medicine clinical pharmacist, is back on Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds podcast to set the record straight.
Delirium affects up to 30% of all hospitalized adults and is known to be associated with significant morbidity and mortality, with cognitive impairments persisting for months and even up to years following the incident hospitalization. And for years, antipsychotics in particular have been considered the mainstay of pharmacotherapy management for this condition, until more recently when retrospective trials and now randomized controlled trials have been published suggesting that potentially these agents aren't as effective as we initially thought. And so that leaves us as clinicians to question whether we are pro or antipsychotic for the management of delirium. My goals for this presentation are threefold: that by the end, you'll be able to identify risk factors for delirium in your various patient populations, while also being able to discuss the recent literature that assesses the use of these agents for delirium in both ICU and non-ICU settings. And then finally, when faced with treating a delirious patient, be equipped with the tools necessary to provide adequate care for them. Delirium, also commonly referred to as acute brain dysfunction or acute brain failure, is characterized by inattention and a disturbance in awareness. And it typically develops over a very short period of time from hours to days and often fluctuates both in severity and in just prevalence overall. Some commonly used scales to both diagnose and then identify the severity of delirium are listed on the right side here. The CAM-ICU is commonly used here at Mayo Clinic for our critically ill patients. And second from the bottom, the MDAS, or the Memorial Delirium Assessment Scale, is one that we see often in our non-ICU populations. The presentation of delirium plays a role in identifying which type that we have. Hyperactive delirium, a patient that is potentially loud, they're restless and agitated, trying to pull out their IV lines or their urinary catheters, but essentially just displaying behaviors that could impede the delivery of care, are considered again to be our hyperactive patients and the form that we're likely most familiar with. On the other hand, we have hypoactive delirium, and this is a little less obvious. Patients here are lethargic, they're withdrawn, they display decreased responsiveness to those that are trying to care for them. And this is, in fact, while probably the least familiar form, the most common form that we see in clinical practice, and is often mis- or underdiagnosed because the symptoms just aren't as clear. And then finally, we have what's considered mixed delirium, in which patients display symptoms of both hypo and hyperactive delirium. But regardless of classification or subtype, risk factor identification plays a pivotal role in both preventing delirium while also managing it once it develops. And so we think about these risk factors in both a predisposing or precipitating sense. Predisposing risk factors are our non-modifiables, essentially. So if we consider a patient that's admitted to our internal medicine service, things that would stand out to you from chart review would be an elderly male who has significant comorbidity burden. A couple that stand out to me from this list are highlighted, including hypertension, dementia, and alcohol abuse. Depression would be another that's not listed here. And then underlying organ dysfunction, such as renal impairment, or just severity of illness at baseline would be things to look for as well. Things you may notice when you just look at the patient would be, do they use eyeglasses or hearing aids, suggesting that they have some form of visual or auditory impairment at baseline? And do they use a cane or a walker or a wheelchair to get around the hallways, alluding to the fact that they have physical impairments which doesn't allow them to perform their activities of daily living compared to a healthy patient. Precipitating risk factors, on the other hand, are considered to be modifiable, and these are areas where we can impact patient care. So again, thinking about it from a chart review perspective first, things you might notice would be patients that are post-surgical following an acute illness such as a STEMI, those that have underlying infection or electrolyte abnormalities, and even anemia or acute blood loss. Uncontrolled pain, constipation, and urinary retention can be risk factors as well. And then moving to the bedside, what are things we would see in the patient's room? Do they have multiple IV lines or an indwelling urinary catheter? Are they restrained to their bed using physical restraints? And then lastly, considering their sleep-wake cycle, are we waking them up multiple times throughout the night for lab draws or medication administrations? Do they have a window in their room, or is that something we can potentially optimize? And then as pharmacists, the area that we're often most concerned with, and appropriately so, is medications. And that is, in fact, the area where we, as medical professionals, can have the greatest impact on patient care. And so I've included here a relatively inclusive list of meds that have been associated with the development of delirium. And a couple that I want to talk about more in depth are highlighted in red. Benzodiazepines have been associated as independent predictors of the transition to delirium in a dose-dependent fashion, in which a higher dose puts a patient at a higher risk of developing delirium. Opioid analgesics act in a similar fashion, in which excess doses can put patients at higher risk. But as I recall on the previous slide, uncontrolled pain is also a risk factor. So we have to balance appropriate pain control with not allowing the patients to have excess opioids at their disposal. And then finally, antihistamines and anticholinergics are highlighted as well, because I see these as characteristics that pervade many different classes of medications. And we as pharmacists are the key player on the team to identify what those medications are and potentially suggest alternatives or way to work around that. And then aside from the individual classes of meds themselves, just the addition of 3 to 5 meds to a patient's list in a 24-hour period, so just making their list longer, puts them at an increased risk as well. And so considering that list of medications and the risk factors we've discussed, I'm going to introduce a patient case, and then we'll go into our first audience response question. So our patient is JB. He's an 68-year-old male admitted to the MICU for a hospital-acquired pneumonia. And his past medical history at this point is significant for coronary artery disease, hypertension, and depression. Active medications for him include aspirin, lisinopril, levofloxacin, and as-needed oxycodone. A baseline BNP reveals hypokalemia along with some underlying renal impairments at baseline. And so if you take out your phones or whatever device you have and open your Poll Everywhere app or text MayoRx to 22333, we have our first question here. So based off of that information, which of the following is a modifiable risk factor for the development of delirium for JB? Is it his age of 68 years, oxycodone 10 milligrams every 4 hours as needed, hypertension, or the use of aspirin daily? Looks like most are pretty quick to the trigger here. So I would agree with the majority of you, or all of you, that oxycodone as needed is the correct answer here. As we talked about on the medication slide, opioids, when used in excess, are a risk factor for developing delirium, but must also be managed with appropriate pain control. Age and hypertension, while risk factors, are not considered to be modifiable. These are things inherent to the patient at baseline. And then aspirin doesn't fall within any of the categories that we previously discussed. And so now that we've talked about what delirium is, how it typically presents, and what risk factors might look like in our various patient populations, how do we manage these patients? And the overarching theme here that I want to preface this discussion with is that non-pharmacologic modifications or interventions are really the cornerstone of all management and should precede any pharmacologic therapy that we give these patients. And so we start first and foremost on the left side with addressing our modifiable risk factors, running through the list, working up our patient, and identifying those which are non-modifiable at baseline and those in which we can impact. Providing supportive care, the main element here is preventing complications of delirium. So thinking about things like DVT prophylaxis, ensuring our patients have adequate hydration and nutrition intake, and getting them up and out of bed so they don't develop deconditioning or pressor ulcers due to being bedbound. And then the final component here is managing symptoms, and I think this is where we're most familiar with managing delirium. And this is things like reorienting the patient to person, place, and time, having their family members come in and be involved in their care, trying to optimize their sleep-wake cycle. And then within this final umbrella of managing symptoms is where our pharmacotherapy lies, with antipsychotics being, again, the mainstay of therapy for quite some time. And as we discuss this literature regarding the use of antipsychotics in delirium, we're going to talk about it first from an ICU perspective, and then transitioning into talking about what does the literature tell us outside of the ICU, so in our medical, our surgical, or our palliative populations. Historically speaking, antipsychotics in the ICU have been considered first line of care for the past two decades or so, with haloperidol being our agent of choice in the early 2000s, as demonstrated by the SCCM guidelines at that time. Over the next 10 years to 15 years, we saw a transition in care and a transition in our guideline recommendations based on literature that was suggesting potentially our atypical antipsychotics are at least as effective and maybe more effective than haloperidol. And then that brings us 5 years forward to 2018, and where we've seen a complete 180 in our recommendation. And this is a result of a growing body of literature suggesting that maybe antipsychotics, again, aren't our first-line agent here. And that leads us to the most recent, largest randomized controlled trial to date in this population that was published at the end of last year in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was conducted by Gerard and colleagues, and the main objective of this trial was to assess the effectiveness of haloperidol and ziprasidone for the treatment of delirium in a critically ill population. This was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial. It was conducted at 16 different centers in the United States. They included over 500 adult patients that were admitted to either a medical or a surgical ICU, and they had delirium, which was diagnosed by a CAM ICU score, so a positive result on that score. Patients were randomized to either haloperidol IV every 12 hours, ziprasidone IV every 12 hours, or placebo. And the population that they ended up enrolling in this trial was about 60 years in age, mostly white males. And in terms of the presenting symptoms of delirium, 80% of this population was hypoactive in nature. So a majority hypoactive population with very little representation of our hyperactive patients. And they assess these patients every 12 hours using, again, the CAM ICU score. If at any time they were positive for delirium, their dose was increased. On the other hand, if they had multiple consecutive assessments suggesting that they no longer had delirium, their dose was either reduced or held altogether. Patients were exposed to about 4 days of therapy in all treatment arms, and the average doses that they achieved were haloperidol 11 milligrams daily and ziprasidone 20 milligrams daily, so about half of what was considered the maximum allowable dose by the protocol. The primary outcome that the authors assessed in this trial was days alive without delirium or coma during a 14-day follow-up period. Notably, this was a composite outcome. What they ended up finding was that across all three groups, there was a non-significant difference in days alive without delirium or coma, with the median, as you can see here, ranging between 7 and 8 days, and the 95% confidence intervals ranging between 5 and 10 for all groups. So very consistent findings for each treatment group. And when they looked at the individual components of this composite outcome, they found that the results were consistent. So we're still seeing non-significant differences with essentially no benefit for our antipsychotics. Secondary efficacy endpoints found similar results, essentially no differences across groups. Things that they looked at were time to liberation from mechanical ventilation, time to ICU or hospital discharge in days, and then death at 30 or 90 days. The most common adverse effects noted in this trial in all groups was sedation, and this affected about 10 to 12% of patients in each group in which that led over sedation led to them needing to hold a dose at some point. Ziprasidone was most commonly associated with QTC prolongation, but that really only resulted in about 2% of patients in that group needing to have their dose held. So not super clinically meaningful at that point. Strengths to support these results would be the fact, again, it was our largest randomized controlled trial to date in this population. They included a rather heterogeneous patient population, which improves our ability to generalize this data to a wide variety of patients we care for on a daily basis. And they also use the CAM-ICU score, which we are very familiar with here at Mayo Clinic, which makes these results easy to apply to our practice. Limitations to note. They did use a composite primary endpoint, as I mentioned before. And I would argue that the dosing of ziprasidone in this trial was potentially suboptimal, or at least not equivalent to the dose of haloperidol that was used. So if we consider this equation here, we have the average dose of haloperidol being 11 milligrams IV daily. This equates to a dose, an oral dose of ziprasidone about 660 milligrams daily. Considering, you know, converting that to IV formulation, that probably runs somewhere between 300 to 400 milligrams of the IV form. But we're still achieving doses of 20 milligrams in this trial that are at least 10 times less what would be considered the equivalent dose to haloperidol. And that's something I'll come back to towards the end of this presentation. And then finally, the IV formulation of ziprasidone is not something that's currently available in the United States, so difficult to apply to practice for obvious reasons. Conclusions to be drawn from this trial. The data essentially demonstrate that we have no evidence to suggest a benefit of antipsychotics in our critically ill patients with hypoactive delirium, which is, again, the majority of the population that they studied. And this largely corroborates the most recent guideline recommendations, which suggest that we should no longer be using antipsychotics across the board for our delirious patients. And so let's practice applying what we've learned from this trial. So coming back to our patient, JB, it's now day 3 of his hospitalization. He's confused and withdrawn, and nursing staff comes up to you and says that he's no longer following commands or cooperating with staff when they're trying to implement CARES. So we have a delirious patient at this point. So if you want to take out your phones, your tablets, whatever you have, and open up Poll Everywhere, we'll come to our next audience response question. So based on the findings from the Garrard and colleagues trial, which of the following is the most appropriate management strategy for JB at this time? Okay, I would agree with the majority of you here, all of you again, that addressing modifiable contributors, or answer B, is the correct answer. Answers A and C would not be correct here because, again, based on this trial, neither antipsychotic arm was associated with reduced days of delirium, reduced time to ICU or hospital discharge, or mortality. So essentially no benefits seen here. So now that we've discussed the literature, or at least briefly talked about the literature in the ICU population, I will remind you that delirium is not isolated to our critically ill patients and does, in fact, affect patients across the continuum of care. And we look at the backdrop of literature leading up to the present time describing the use of antipsychotics outside of the ICU, we find first that we lack robust guideline recommendations in order to inform our pharmacotherapy decision making. What we're essentially left with over the past 2 decades is a collection of small, single-center studies conducted outside of the U.S. with suboptimal study designs and variable dosing schemes in terms of the agents that they studied, and so a limited body of literature with which to guide our decision-making. That said, our most recent trial to date, and again one of our most well-powered and appropriately designed studies, was conducted by Agar and colleagues and published in 2017 in JAMA. And what this group of investigators looked at was the efficacy of risperidone and haloperidol compared to placebo for patients with symptomatic delirium that were near the end of life. This was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trial conducted at 11 centers in Australia, and these were either hospice centers or inpatient palliative care services. Included over 200 adult patients that had advanced or progressing disease and had delirium diagnosed based on a couple different factors. So they first had to have a diagnosis based on the DSM-IV criteria. They had to have an MDS score greater than or equal to 7, which again is diagnostic for delirium. And then this scale was used to assess the severity of delirium throughout the rest of the trial. And they also had to have or display target symptoms of distress associated with delirium, which the authors identified as either being inappropriate behavior, inappropriate communication, or hallucinations and illusions. And they used the nursing delirium screening scale in order to identify those symptoms. These 200 patients were randomized to either oral risperidone, oral haloperidol, or placebo in a 1-to-1-to-1 fashion. And just notice the dosing used here, and I'll come back and compare this to the dosing used in the previous trial. In contrast to the first study that we looked at, this patient population was much older. So the average age here was about 75 years old. They're still mostly male. And their past medical history was significant for oncology in almost 90% of cases. So a population that's laden with cancer in terms of their past medical history. And they also had a higher degree of baseline cognitive impairment compared to the first group that we assessed as well. And considering that this was a relatively old population, I'll also point out that in all elderly patients, they reduced the initial dose by half. And so really these patients were only receiving 0.25 milligrams orally of haloperidol every 12 hours. And these are very, very low doses. Assessments were done every 8 hours using the symptom score that I described previously. And if at any point they were displaying symptoms of delirium, their dose was increased. On the other hand, if they exhibited adverse effects such as extrapyramidal symptoms, if their severity of their delirium was reduced, or if they were no longer exhibiting symptoms, their dose was reduced as well. The primary outcome that they assessed was improvement in that average symptom score between baseline and day three. So it was a 72-hour follow-up. And what the authors were looking for here was a reduction in that symptom score, which would equate to an improvement in symptoms. What they actually found was that in both treatment groups, so our antipsychotic arms, when compared to placebo, were associated with significantly higher symptom scores, both at study end and on a daily basis. And when they performed a multivariate analysis, controlling for confounders such as age, gender, cancer history, and exposure to benzodiazepines and opioids, which we know can contribute to delirium, they found similar results. So to orient you to this graph, we have our symptom scores on the y-axis and our time and days on the x-axis. Our antipsychotic arms are in blue and green, and our placebo arm in red. All three groups started out at about a symptom score of about 3, so a similar baseline in terms of the symptoms they're displaying at that point. And we see a separation as early as day 1, with the greatest difference between groups demonstrated on day 3. While we're seeing reductions in all groups, our antipsychotic groups aren't necessarily improving things, and they may actually be worsening symptoms in this specific patient population. Secondary outcomes revealed that in addition to more symptoms, we also saw greater delirium severity on a daily basis. Antipsychotics were associated with a higher incidence of extrapyramidal symptoms, not a surprising finding. And then finally, both treatment arms had reduced median survival compared to placebo. And this difference in median survival was about 10 days between our placebo and our antipsychotic arms. Whether this is truly attributable to the antipsychotics used at the doses that we saw in this protocol, it's hard to say, but I think it's an interesting finding from this study. And then one other result that the authors commented on was the use of rescue midazolam, which was available to patients every 2 hours. And what we see on days 1, 2, and 3 is that patients in the antipsychotic arms received significantly more benzodiazepines than the placebo group. So a couple conclusions that you could draw from this. Number one, our antipsychotics aren't controlling our symptoms, and so clinicians in this trial had to reach for their second-line agent in order to attempt to control symptoms. And two, we talked earlier about how benzodiazepines are a risk factor for delirium. So is this use of benzodiazepines here potentially contributing to the worsened symptoms and the increased severity that we see in the antipsychotic arms? Limitations to note in this trial, they use symptom and severity-based outcomes. And I will say that this is consistent across the other trials that I included in my timeline. So we do see these used in other settings as well. But I think it's harder to apply findings from these trials using these scales, apply that to practice compared to using the CAM-ICU scale, where a patient either does or doesn't have delirium. Here, we're trying to identify if an increase of 0.48 units on a symptom scale is actually clinically meaningful or not. This study also allowed the as-needed use of midazolam, as I mentioned on the previous slide, Does that just show that we aren't controlling symptoms, or is that potentially contributing to the outcomes we see? And then finally, the low doses. I'll come back to this idea. Remember in the previous trial, the dose of haloperidol was 2.5 milligrams IV every 12 hours. And here, most of our patients were started on a dose of 0.25 milligrams by mouth every 12 hours. Now there's a 1-to-2 conversions from IV to PO, and so we're really, really giving low doses of antipsychotics. Can we attribute the findings to that low of a dose? Conclusions to be drawn. We have another large randomized trial suggesting here that there is no benefit for antipsychotics in reducing symptoms of delirium in what is this time a hyperactive or mixed delirium cohort of palliative care patients. And perhaps are antipsychotics in this setting doing more harm than they are good? So to summarize where we stand with antipsychotics in the treatment of delirium, let's review the literature that we've talked about so far. So in our hypoactive, critically ill patient, taking into account results from the Gerard and colleagues trial, the first trial that we looked at, I would say that we have little to no evidence demonstrating that antipsychotics should be used in this setting. In our non-ICU patients with hypoactive delirium, so our general medicine and palliative care patients, while I didn't really go into depth on that literature, I realize, I would also argue that the literature here lacks robust randomized controlled trials that would demonstrate that antipsychotics are useful. And furthermore, I think we're naturally less inclined to treat a non-critically ill patient with an antipsychotic when they're delirious, especially our palliative care patients, in whom our goal at the end of life is typically to reduce their pharmacologic burden versus just adding another medication to their list. Moving down to the bottom right then, we learned from our Agar and colleagues trial that when antipsychotics were used at very low doses, they had little role and potentially worsened symptoms in a hyperactive patient population nearing the end of life. However, ethically speaking, if a patient is nearing the end of life and has very severe delirium, are we going to really withhold treatment that could potentially make them more comfortable in the last few days of their life and increase the quality of the time that they have with their family? I'm not sure. And then in a medical and surgical patient populations, I think there are still questions to be answered in terms of how to appropriately manage these patients from a pharmacologic perspective. And then finally, in our bottom left-hand corner here, so for our hyperactive, critically ill patients, I would again say that we lack robust literature suggesting that we should lean one way or another with antipsychotics. The overarching theme then here being that in our hyperactive patients, regardless of setting, I think that's where our research should be targeted in the future in order to answer some of these questions that we're still left with despite these newer, well-powered randomized controlled trials. So while I spent the past 20 minutes or so reiterating that antipsychotics have little role at best for the management of delirium, I think we would all agree that when faced with a patient that has hyperactive delirium, regardless of setting, something needs to be done in order to improve their overall quality of life. And so let's talk about what steps can be taken and what actions we as pharmacists can take in particular in order to improve patient outcomes. So considering a hyperactive patient on the floor, first and foremost, I'll come back to this concept yet again, is addressing modifiable risk factors. For us as pharmacists, that means we focus on medications. Are there opioids or benzodiazepines, other medications that we can potentially remove from the patient's list, or at least suggest an alternative? And if that's not the case, is a dose reduction possible? Thinking about administration, I mentioned that we often wake up patients multiple times throughout the night for medication administrations. Can we change a Q6-hour med that's being given around the clock to 4 times daily to at least minimize that awakening due to med administration? And then if the patient's able to take things by mouth, can we change an IV formulation to an oral formulation? Small things like that can make a big difference as well. Supportive care. Our big role here that I alluded to previously was ensuring all of our patients have DVT prophylaxis, either in the form of anticoagulation or SCDs. We are often some of the first members of the medical team to identify patients with constipation, which can be a significant complexity of a patient that has delirium. And so finding that early and treating it as appropriate. Non-pharmacologic interventions, I have mentioned this before as being the cornerstone of therapy, and as such, we'll come back to this on the next slide so I can give a few specifics of what that looks like. And then, of course, inevitably, there are going to be situations where we need to reach for pharmacotherapy, antipsychotics being our mainstay. But there are also other agents that have been studied for this indication. I leave this here more as an FYI, just to let you know that medications such as valproate, melatonin, remeltion, all of these have been studied in limited trials in this indication, and that some of them suggest positive outcomes. But in the case that you're managing a patient with hyperactive delirium, just know that that literature is there and there may be other options. But for the remainder of this presentation, we're going to talk first about non-pharmacologic interventions and then come back to this idea of when we use antipsychotics, how do we do so appropriately? I've touched on this many times, and that's because non-pharmacologic interventions are the only guideline-recommended and evidence-based interventions we have in our toolbox for managing a delirious patient. Multiple randomized controlled trials and meta-analyses have shown that when multiple interventions are implemented at one time, they are shown to reduce the duration of delirium, length of stay, and mortality. And so highly beneficial interventions to make. Specifics, what does this actually look like in patient care? So again, reorienting the patient, that's why we see whiteboards in each of our hospital rooms that list the date, who their doctor is, and what the plan is for the day. Getting the patient up and out of bed as early as possible, and if that's not feasible, ensuring that they participate in PT and OT on a daily basis. Again, coming back to simple things like eyeglasses and hearing aids, if they use them at baseline, ensure that they have them available in the hospital as well. And then finally, the sleep-wake cycle and hydration and feeding, which I've talked about a couple times already. And you may be looking at me and thinking, Abby, I have zero role in carrying out any of these in clinical practice. I'm a pharmacist. I look at medications. And I would just encourage you to be active in educating our medical teams and our medical colleagues that these should really be our first-line interventions before reaching for pharmacotherapy. This is where our evidence lies. But in cases where antipsychotics are going to be used, how do we do so appropriately and effectively? I'll remind you that the entire reason why we use antipsychotics for this indication is because there's believed to be an excess of dopamine in the central nervous system, which leads to the symptoms of hyperactive delirium, such as agitation, restlessness, hallucinations. And so using an antidopaminergic agent or an antipsychotic would then be beneficial in this setting. So understanding that, the effectiveness of these agents is largely attributed to their activity at the dopamine receptor. And their side effect profiles then are closely related to how they act at off-site receptors, including our alpha, our histamine, and our muscarinic receptors. So starting at the top of this table and moving down, Haldol has been our drug of choice for the past 2 decades, as I mentioned earlier, likely due to its high affinity for the D2 receptor with minimal activity at off-site receptors. That said, it also has a high risk of extrapyramidal symptoms. Olanzapine, an agent that may also be effective, but likely in higher doses, is also going to demonstrate significant sedation, and anticholinergic effects such as constipation or urinary retention due to its activity at histamine and muscarinic receptors, respectively. Risperidone is really an agent we don't see used very commonly here at Mayo Clinic, but potentially effective based on its high affinity for the dopamine receptor, but notable orthostatic hypotension can be seen with this agent. Quetiapine is potentially the most interesting of all the medications on this list, because when you compare its affinity for the D2 receptor to that of other antipsychotics, we see that it's very low. And so in order to be effective, we must push doses of this drug pretty high, at least much higher than we actually use it for this indication. And with that, we're going to see significant sedation due to its activity at the histamine receptor and then potential anticholinergic effects as well. But again, notably, we use quetiapine probably at doses of 12.5, 25, and 50. It's arguable whether or not we're even hitting the dopamine receptor at that point. And then lastly is ziprasidone, an agent that prior to the Garrard trial was very infrequently studied, but again, at high doses may be effective and is arguably the cleanest of all of our antipsychotics based on minimal activity at off-site receptors. Other considerations that I'll leave you with in order to guide your dosing decisions moving forward would be this idea of dose equivalence. I mentioned this in the Garrard trial, But I would encourage you that when an order for an atypical antipsychotic comes through, to consider what that would be in Haldol equivalence. Is that then considered a high dose of haloperidol? Are we essentially barely giving a dose at all and maybe not, again, touching those dopamine receptors? All of these agents are associated with QTC prolongation. We know that as pharmacists, but the IV form of haloperidol and ziprasidone have the highest risk for QTC prolongation. And then unique considerations for each of these agents are listed on the far right-hand side here. Some that I will leave you with would be that Haldol is our only IV option, and it's important to remember the IV to PO conversion when transitioning between those formulations. Risperidone has a similar risk for extrapyramidal symptoms as haloperidol when used at doses greater than 4 to 6 milligrams per day. Olanzapine has a unique adverse effect profile when the intramuscular form is used along with injectable benzodiazepines. It's been shown to result in significant cardiorespiratory depression, such as hypotension, difficulty of breathing, and this can lead to mortality. So something to be aware of, especially because these agents are commonly used together for this specific indication. Quetiapine should be dosed at bedtime due to sedation, and here at Mayo Clinic Rochester is available in a suppository form. But do realize that that is probably solely seen here. If you go somewhere else and try to order a quetiapine suppository, you're going to be pretty disappointed. And then finally, ziprasidone is an agent that we typically only give by mouth and therefore must be taken with food in order to optimize its bioavailability. So a lot of information there, but let's take what we've learned about these agents and apply it to one final rendition of our patient case. So JB is now on day 5 of his hospitalization, and we see another acute change in his mental status. He's acutely agitated, he starts pulling out his IV lines, and he's telling you that he's seeing people walk around his room that aren't actually there. And the medical resident comes up to you and says, "We've optimized everything else that we can. I want to use an antipsychotic for JB. What do you recommend?" And when you review his medical chart, you see that his current QTC is 495. So if you take out your devices one last time, which of the following is associated with the highest risk of QTC prolongation and therefore would not be the drug of choice for our patient? Is it A, quetiapine, B, olanzapine, C, risperidone, or D, ziprasidone? So I would agree with everyone here yet again. Ziprasidone is the correct answer, along with the IV form of haloperidol, is associated with the greatest risk for QTC prolongation. A, B, and C, while also known to prolong the QTC, are not as high of risk as the two that we mentioned previously. So in summary, a couple take-home points. The recent evidence demonstrates an overall lack of benefit for the use of antipsychotics in a hypoactive delirious patient. With that said, antipsychotic use may still be warranted in our hyperactive, agitated, delirious patients. And in those situations, as the medication experts on the team, it's important to consider both adverse effect profiles and dose equivalence when selecting or at least advising the selection of a certain regimen. And then finally, and potentially most importantly, non-pharmacologic strategies do remain the cornerstone of delirium management. And it's our role to educate other providers on the healthcare team that these should be our first-line strategies before reaching for pharmacotherapy.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.